This is an ABC podcast.
More than 4,000 people work at Parliament House in Canberra, and one in three have experienced sexual harassment. One in three. It's supposed to be a symbol of our democracy and freedom, but behind the scenes, Parliament is anything but. It's filled with power imbalances, bullying, sexual harassment and assault. G'day, this is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, filling in for Avani Dias this week, and we're getting right into this explosive workplace culture review that's been released. The Prime Minister says he wishes he found the report more surprising. In a minute, we're going to chat to one of the government's most senior ministers, Simon Birmingham, about this. Also coming up, visa holders desperate to get back into Australia will not be coming back from tomorrow. And sex toys anybody can use.
Hack. I also want to thank Brittany Higgins for standing up and speaking up about these issues in relation to the terrible events.
On Triple J.
Yeah, it's been 9 months since Brittany Higgins came forward with shocking allegations of abuse in federal parliament. And today, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, released her long-awaited review into workplace culture there. It's found more than half of workers experienced at least one incident of bullying, sexual harassment, or actual or attempted sexual assault. And it's calling for changes, things like gender targets, new alcohol policies, and just more transparency. Joe Lauder has more.
One of the issues that the Jenkins report deals with is respect. And I'm not quite sure what whoever found that so funny laughed out loud then.
If you're someone who only tunes into politics occasionally, question time seems like a zoo some days, and the R word isn't one you hear a lot there.
There will be a lot of discussion over the next days and weeks over respect in this place. And I would ask members, all members, to show that level of respect in this chamber as well.
The Speaker's talking about the report that came out today into the workplace culture of federal parliament. It was done by Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins and was commissioned in March after former Liberal Party staffer Brittany Higgins came forward with allegations she was raped inside Parliament House.
I also want to thank Brittany Higgins for her courage in speaking up about these issues. And her voice has spoken for many, as this report shows.
The report's findings are really damning. One in three people working in federal parliament have experienced some kind of sexual harassment there. And half of workers experienced at least one incident of bullying, sexual harassment, or actual or attempted sexual assault.
Like anyone who works in this building, I find the statistics that are presented there, of course, appalling and disturbing. I wish I found them more surprising, but I find them just as appalling.
Over 1,700 people have contributed to the report, and it covers anyone who works or has worked in Parliament, from staff in MPs' offices, public servants, as well as politicians themselves, journos and more. It also highlights some of the distressing comments from anonymous interviews like these ones.
The MP sitting beside me leaned over, also thinking he wanted to tell me something. I leaned in. He grabbed me and stuck his tongue down my throat. The others all laughed. It was revolting and humiliating.
Frequently, like at least every week, the advice was to go and cry in the toilet so that nobody can see you. Because that's what it's like up here.
And the situation is even worse for young workers at Parliament. According to the report, younger participants said their limited work experience made it harder for them to be sure when behaviour crossed the line. And LGBTQIA people also experienced sexual harassment at higher rates. A number of people also told the review about being warned about not being alone with some pollies.
I got told beforehand, don't get too drunk. You're a young gay man. He's a predatory older gay man. And he'll go for it. If there is the right opportunity, he'll pick a target in the room, ply them with booze, and then try it on.
The report's author, Kate Jenkins, says there are some key reasons why this is happening in Parliament.
We did find the four key drivers of this misconduct were power imbalances, gender inequality, lack of accountability, and really lack of diversity.
And she says it's not like most workplaces.
The fear, loyalty, and particularly that sort of political dynamic that exists inevitably in Parliament. This is a fly-in, fly-out, 22 weeks you're in Canberra, the rest of the time you're at your location, irregular hours, high pressure, high scrutiny, lots of focus, really quite unusual. You can't really compare it to many other industries in that sense.
She says alcohol was also another issue that came up a lot when they spoke about sexual harassment and bullying in Parliament.
So we have given some guidance that there should be some restrictions and some governance around that, really to bring it in line with what happens in most workplaces in Australia now.
They've made 28 recommendations all up, including setting targets for the number of women MPs. The Minister for Women, Maurice Payne, says the government's going to consider all the recommendations in the report.
So as the Prime Minister has said, we'll look at these 28 recommendations very closely and thoughtfully and positively.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, I'm keen to hear what you think about this report that's found our federal parliament really isn't a safe workplace for so many people. Send me a message, 0439 757 555. Maybe your work has a similar culture. David in Melbourne says if the boss is surprised by anything about their workplace, that's a pretty key bad finding. We're going to get some more reaction now from Simon Birmingham. He's the finance minister and his department's actually responsible for people working in parliament. He joins me now. Minister, welcome to Hack.
Hello, Dave. Good to be with you.
This review's found that Parliament is riddled with bullying, sexual harassment and assault. The Prime Minister's called it appalling and disturbing. Your department's responsible for parliamentary employees. What do you think?
Well, I think it does highlight some practices and behaviour that go back a long period of time and clearly are thoroughly unacceptable and that do warrant change. And I'm very pleased that the report we have from the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, provides a clear roadmap for change, building upon a number of things that we've done already this year in response to some of the highly distressing allegations that we've seen come out at the start of the year that prompted this review. But we haven't waited for the review. We've acted in terms of putting in place better support structures, better training arrangements, and crucially, better arrangements for the receipt and independent handling of complaints and more transparency around the outcomes of those complaints. And now we're going to take all of that work even further.
See, we'll get to that in a minute, but the Prime Minister said that he wished he found these findings more surprising, and I'm just wondering, did you find them surprising?
I don't know that I found them surprising given all that has come to light during the course of the year, but I found them deeply depressing. And I hope, first and foremost, that for the many, many good people who work in the nation's parliament, staffers, be they Liberal or Labor, Green or National, Independent, whatever background they may be, they come to this place with a sense of pride that they've got a job working in the nation's parliament, and they should be proud of the exceptional hard work that so many of them do, and we shouldn't allow this sort of behaviour to be a permanent stain or blight on the many good people who work here. We've got to make sure we fix it, that we change that culture and have the practices to drive that cultural change so that everybody can not just come here with pride in their job but leave here with their pride intact.
Yeah, but I'm just seeing like a statistic like this, 26% of people sexually harassed were harassed by a parliamentarian. That's an MP. That's a potential colleague or former colleague. It clearly shows that this is a problem at the top. And also, as an MP yourself, you surely are very disturbed by that.
Well, I am, Dave, and one of the very important parts of the reforms we put in place during the course of the year was to make sure there was a mechanism where if an MP was found to be at fault, that could be made public and more transparent than has been the case previously.
We've only got 11% of staff, though, who've experienced sexual harassment reporting it. And I know you're talking about making changes to the reporting mechanism, but clearly there's so much more that has to happen beyond that. There's a part of the report that says from the get-go there's no incentive to actually report because it's not going to change it and it's probably actually going to make it worse. This is a feeling that's deeply entrenched inside Parliament House, and you're going to have to figure out a way to address it. What are you going to do?
Well, Dave, there's a number of things that we have to do. You've got to take the cultural changes to stop it at the start because you don't want the behaviour happening in the first place. But part of that is clearly also to ensure that that people know if it happens, there are thorough, independent processes in place that people can take a complaint to lift the proportion of those who do complain so that they have confidence in the independence and the integrity of the complaints process and that those who may do the wrong thing know that there will be consequences from those complaint processes. And that's in part what we've managed to build during the course of this year. But Kate Jenkins's work provides a very strong roadmap for us to take that even further.
I've heard, you know, Parliament being compared to other workplaces, and, you know, Kate Jenkins did make it pretty clear, this is not another workplace. This is the Federal Parliament of Australia, and there are so many people listening who are deeply, deeply upset by what they're reading and hearing today. The review makes 28 recommendations. Is the government going to implement all of them?
We are going to work with other parties to make sure that we respond positively to all of them.
What does that mean, respond positively? Well, is that implementing all of them?
They're not all recommendations for the government, so they do require us to work across party lines. What we did in establishing this review was I sat down with the opposition, the Labor Party, the Greens, other minor parties and independents, as well as staff, current and former, to agree the reviewer, to agree the terms of reference, to agree the timeline for reporting and all of those different elements. We've worked with those other parties on some of the reforms I've spoken about during the course of this year. Now I want to make sure we bring everybody back to the table to act on all of these recommendations. That is certainly the government's intention, and we want to make sure we get everybody's support in doing so.
Because, as we know, this whole review was sparked by Brittany Higgins' allegations of sexual assault in the Parliament, but it took the Prime Minister months to even organise a meeting with Brittany Higgins. Why should Australians have any confidence that the government's going to act on this?
Because we have acted during the course of this year, as I've outlined during this interview, Dave, that we have put in place new independent structures, new training arrangements, all of them with transparency measures attached to them that will ensure Australians can see whether their MP or senator has actually undertaken the required training in relation to workplace practices, that they will see ultimately the outcomes of investigations into workplace harassment or bullying if action isn't taken in accordance with what's recommended and required. So we've taken those steps already. We're going to now build on those by working collaboratively with all the rest of the Parliament and all other political parties to make sure that that the roadmap Kate Jenkins has given us today is one we deliver upon.
All right, Minister, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dave.
We're hearing from a lot of people on the text line. If he's not surprised, why has nothing been done? Prime Minister, as always, shallow and inconsistent. Another person says, oh, yay, more recommendations. We all know how those pan out in Parliament. And a person with a very, very personal comment says, I turned away from politics very early on because of the lack of respect and underlying misogyny I could see in a world where leading on a line of burn the witch was considered okay is not something I want to be involved in or have my votes anywhere near. And tomorrow, Commissioner Kate Jenkins is actually going to join us on Hack to discuss this issue and a few others. So make sure that you tune in for that.
Hack. To analyse and to understand the full nature of the Omicron variant, we will put a pause of international arrivals on Triple J.
Yeah, we've been gearing up, to throw our borders open to more and more people around the world, but that's all been shelved because of this new COVID variant. Some of the people most impacted are international students, skilled migrants, and humanitarian visa holders. After almost 2 years of uncertainty, they were finally going to be allowed back in tomorrow, but instead they'll have to wait at least another fortnight as the government works out how it's going to deal with Omicron. Meghna Bali has the story.
Since 2020, I've been stuck here. I was so depressed. Every day I wake up in the morning, but there's no hope.
This is Balraj Sandhu. He's a 27-year-old guy from Melbourne, and he's speaking to me from Punjab in India, where he's been stuck for the last 2 years.
I left Australia in 2020 for 2 months because I had a wedding.
It was his wedding, actually. He was gearing up to come back to Australia with his wife when we shut our borders to the world. And because Balraj is on a temporary work visa, he wasn't allowed back in.
It's very hard. Really, really very hard last 2 years because I can't start do working or anything here because I almost been lived in Australia 6 years.
Balraj was 18 when he moved to Melbourne to study hospitality. He had a great group of friends, a stable job, and felt like the $80,000 he'd spent on his studies and visa was really paying off. But over the last 2 years, Balraj tells me he's felt kind of abandoned by the Australian government. That was until a week ago, when the PM announced our borders open to the world again.
From the 1st of December 2021, fully vaccinated, eligible visa holders will be able to come to Australia without needing to apply for a travel exemption.
That meant that international students, skilled migrants and humanitarian visa holders would finally be allowed back in. And Balraj was stoked.
When I heard that news, I was very happy. And already I booked my flight on the 7th of December.
But then, over the weekend, reports of a new variant of concern called Omicron started hitting headlines.
Oh, shit. Here we go again.
A new COVID strain is raising alarms around the world.
It didn't take long for our leaders to impose a two-week pause on international arrivals.
I was like crying. I told to my parents, I said, there's no hope. I hope I never go back. I can't.
In a press conference this morning, Home Affairs Minister Karen Andrews said the government was acutely aware of the impact this decision would have.
It wasn't a decision that the Australian government took lightly. We have been very focused on doing all we can to open our international borders as safely but as quickly as we possibly can do.
There are 5 cases of people diagnosed with Omicron in Australia. And what we know is they're young, double-vaxxed and have mild symptoms. But Chief Medical Officer Professor Paul Kelly says there's a bunch of stuff we don't know, so it's important to move cautiously.
This is a temporary pause so we can get that information that we need, but we are committed to continue to reopen.
For Balraj, who was finally starting to see the light at the end of his 2-year-long struggle, the assurances don't mean much.
I feel hopeless and helpless at the moment. They just close. They don't care about skilled migrants. They don't care about students.
The decision to pause the reopening of borders doesn't just affect the tens of thousands of people stuck overseas. There are actually a heap of temp visa holders here who haven't been able to go to their home countries.
I think I've had nightmares where, you know, I've so many times just packed my bags, thinking that, you know, I need to leave.
Muskan Gumbar booked her flights to India just hours after last week's announcement that the borders were reopening. She lives in Sydney on a work visa and hasn't been able to visit her family because of fears she'd get stuck there.
When I first heard about the fact that, you know, borders are opening, I had a certain timeline. That gave me hope that there's an end to this. But now it's again about the fact that, you know, you can't trust when are we going to go back. That leads you to sort of like not having hope.
Muskan gets why the pause is important, but feels like there's a double standard in the way non-citizens and permanent residents have been treated throughout the pandemic.
From the lack of better words, it feels like a second-class citizen. I mean, I pay taxes. You know, I'm not taking benefits. The least I want is to be able to like freely go in and out of the country.
For now, her travel plans are up in the air.
I wanted to use, you know, the mandatory break that every employee is, you know, supposed to take towards the end of the year. And I wanted that just like everyone spends it with their family. I just wanted to spend it with mine. But now I'm not quite sure if that's going to materialise.
Hack on Triple J.
Meghna Bali with that story. Vicky Thompson is the head of the Group of Eight, which represents some of Australia's biggest unis. And she joins me now. Vicky, thanks for joining me on the program.
Hi, Dave. Great to be with you.
You must be pretty disappointed with this news that borders will stay closed for at least another 2 weeks. It's not great news for international students.
Well, it's not. And we've just heard 2 examples of that in the excellent package. I mean, it's no doubt it's a curveball at the 11th hour for our students. But, you know, we have followed the health advice throughout this entire pandemic in Australia. And, you know, we have to continue to do that and trust that our health authorities are doing the right thing. I think the emphasis is on hopefully it is a pause for all the obvious reasons that, you know, we don't want this variant running rife anyway in our community, but we want our borders open as quickly as we can for our students. And hopefully that will be from the 15th of December. But we certainly understand it's incredibly unsettling for students both onshore, and I think that point was made, but also for our students who are offshore. So it has a huge impact.
We're actually hearing that a flight filled with international students is going to arrive in Sydney next week because the New South Wales is going ahead with its international student pilot program. Do you support this?
So my understanding with that, and I think the Prime Minister clarified that today, is that that under the New South Wales International Arrivals Pilot Program, there's 2 flights that are due to come in from Singapore because we have that green lane sort of through Singapore and I think with New Zealand, and that they are Singaporean students who will come in and then go through the appropriate quarantining program. So I think that's, it's appropriate, I guess, in the context and great for those students, but we've still got a lot of students offshore, in our case, 30,000 students offshore that we need to get back, not including, of course, our new students who want to start in January next year. So we'd certainly be urging our students who are listening and who are offshore and hearing sort of confusing and conflicting advice, stick with us and, keep going through with your visa application. I think the government has acted appropriately in terms of the health advice, and we have to take them to their word that this will be a short pause for the right reasons.
And I guess, you're talking about tens of thousands of students who do want to come back to Australia. Are you worried, though, that they may not be back, that the damage has been done and they're probably thinking of new plans?
Look, that's a really tough one, because what we've found, for us at least across the group of eight, is that our students, and we were concerned about exactly your point, but our students really stuck with us. And, that's hard graft, because they've had to do their studies online for effectively almost 2 years now. But our students stuck with us. So I guess that's my point. Can you just hang in there a little bit longer? Because this is unfortunate. We have to follow the health advice. Countries around the world are having to review their international border arrangements at the moment. The federal government has indicated that it is a pause, so that's what we're sort of all fingers crossed. So that's why we're sort of saying to our students, please carry on with, your visa application, so that when the time comes, hopefully on the 15th, you can secure a flight and you can get back into Australia as quickly as possible.
All right, Vicky Thompson from the Group of Eight, thank you so much for jumping on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
Hack. I talk a lot about my sexuality and I talk a lot about my inability to masturbate.
On Triple J.
Yeah, a bit of a content warning for this one. Got some adult themes, so tune out if you've got some young ones around. But look, we all enjoy spending a bit of time with ourselves, if you know what I mean. But for a lot of people in society, mobility issues mean that masturbating or using a sex toy on their own just isn't a possibility. That's not because people living with disability don't have the same sex drive as the rest of us. It's because products aren't designed with them in mind until now. A brother-sister duo has created a disability-specific sex toy. Look, it's not something that I would have done with my siblings, but the pair's all about busting taboos about sexuality and disability. Shalala Medora has more.
I had to ask my care worker. I had to, have a 20-minute conversation with her. I was like, hey, so can you come up and help me masturbate?
Andrew Gerza has spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy and is a disability advocate. He uses a wheelchair and needs help completing everyday tasks. Andrew's speaking to me from his home in Toronto, Canada, and telling me about the time he got asked to review a sex toy.
Can you help me with this? And so she did, but I had to explain to her, she had to put it on, and then she was like, okay, I'll be back in 20 minutes, bye. And it was so awkward, because I was like, what if it takes me longer than 20 minutes to get to that sweet spot? What?
Andrew didn't end up needing that 20 minutes after all.
Then I very quickly realized when I turned on the toy that I couldn't reach the buttons, that it was going too fast, that it was actually hurting me. So I had to take the toy off and call her and be like, well, that was embarrassing.
Andrew loves breaking taboos about sex and disability.
Coming out and saying I'm queer was easy. Saying I'm also queer and disabled was extremely hard.
In 2017, Andrew was part of a documentary called Picture This.
In that moment when they're touching you, that body part isn't yours anymore. They have taken control of that to give you the care you need, and it's no longer yours.
Heather Morrison, Andrew's sister, watched the doco.
That was a light bulb moment for her.
Heather hadn't realised the difficulty her brother had in exploring his sexuality or using sex toys until that very moment.
We kind of said, well, should we make one?
And that's exactly what they did.
It looks like if a body pillow and a foam roller had a love child.
They started the long process of creating the Bumpin' joystick. First, Heather and Andrew consulted with the disability community itself to make sure the product was designed with them in mind.
And so what we've tried to do with the design is to take and remove reliance on fine motor skills and hands out of the equation as much as possible.
Basically, Bumpin' has a sleeve in the middle for sex toys that users can maneuver onto their bodies in a way that feels good for them.
Been designed that way because it actually allows people to hug around it and hug into it.
The disability community was consulted on every aspect of its design.
So we really started from how do we make this user journey go all the way from packaging to cleaning it up and putting it away?
From what I can tell, it looks like it's going to tick a lot of boxes because there was a lot of discussion with the community about the issues they have with toys on the market at the moment.
Samuel Hunter is a straight male escort who has many disabled clients. He's also a disability support worker.
There's a lot of trust when dealing with someone with a disability in like a sexual nature. Like if they go home with someone on a one-night stand, they're going to ask them to possibly help them out of their wheelchair or try to tell them about, no, you can't bend my leg that way, my hips don't work like that.
Samuel says a lot of his clients don't get a chance to explore their sexuality, even if they really want to. He gives me an example of his most recent client, a woman in her 30s who lives with her parents.
That client can't even masturbate because there's always support workers around and they'll just walk in checking in on her, so there's no real privacy.
He says there's a huge gap in the market for a sex toy like Bumpin', something that people with mobility issues can access independently. He's looking forward to giving it a go when it hits the market in the middle of next year.
I'd love to get my hands on it and discover it myself to go, oh yeah, that I definitely would recommend this.
You know, sometimes you'll find the perfect toy but it'll just have this really tiny button and you're like, oh no, like if there was just scope or a bigger button or there's just small adjustments that could be made that might make it more accessible.
Alicia Melita is an educator at disability support provider Northcote. She runs Feel the Vibe, aka Sexpo for Disability. She says there have been improvements in sex toys for people with mobility issues.
Being able to control toys with your phone, your iPad, has been a great thing for some people with disabilities.
But the biggest barrier is broader society. We in general don't like to think of people with disability as sexual beings, and so we don't create sex toys with them in mind.
I guess there's also lots of myths as well surrounding sex and disability.
And busting those myths is one of the biggest motivators for Andrew and Heather.
And the more you can bring that this topic into the open, the more you're doing for our community who's really felt like they've been over ignored and overlooked for a really long time, because they have been.
Hack on Triple J.
That story from Shalila Medora, and someone who's able to give us a bit more insight into this is Mohamed Samra. Mo is a sexuality advocate and he's a person with cerebral palsy. Mo, thanks very much for coming on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've spoken before about your experiences accessing sex workers and how it's changed your life. What has been your experience, Mo?
From when I first started, I didn't know what to expect when I first started seeing sex workers, but I can honestly say it's been such an eye-opening experience, and honestly, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Why do you think it is that, you know, a lot of people in society still have all this stigma about people with disability and their right to live the sexual life that they choose to live?
Because people assume just because we have a disability that we don't want to explore our sexual nature, and we don't want to explore our bodies in a safe and a secure environment. And that shouldn't be the case. Everyone should be able to experience, you know, sexuality however they want, you know, and no one should judge that based on disability.
And what kind of difference does improving the sex lives of people with disability make to overall quality of life, in your opinion, Mo?
Well, I can speak from personal experience that it brings you a sense of joy, it brings you a sense of independence, it makes you feel a lot happier. Another aspect of it is that it releases back pain and chronic pain that you may have on a temporary basis as well.
Hack on Triple J.
That's sexuality advocate Mohamed Samra there. That's all we've got time for the Hack podcast. We'll have more tomorrow. I'll see you then.